Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. We have a few quick announcements to start our show. This Tuesday night, August 1st, is National Night Out Against Crime. The San Diego Sheriff's Department invites the public to a dozen events countywide, including East County events in Alpine, Lemon Grove, Ramona, Rancho San Diego, and Santee. You can meet deputies who patrol your neighborhood, get crime prevention tips, and more. Get details in the Crime Beat section at eastcountymagazine.org. Now, if you live in Spring Valley, be aware that a resident on Dictionary Hill has reported seeing a mountain lion documented on a backyard camera on Sangamon Avenue last week. The Campo Lake Morena Planning Group has a vacancy for a volunteer member to serve that community. And next up, we'll have a national news story about an inflammatory speech by President Trump inciting violence by police and a reaction from law enforcement, including a local candidate for sheriff. Authorities are asking public help to find an animal abuser who taped the muzzle of a dog shut before later abandoning it in Santee. We'll have details. Then our very special guest is Andrew Zelt. He's a sheriff sergeant who is the first Republican candidate to declare that he's running against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. So stay tuned for these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. Law enforcement leaders across the nation are denouncing remarks made by President Donald Trump that critics say encourages police brutality. Here is what President Trump said while speaking to law enforcement officers at Suffolk County Community College in New York.
It's essential that Congress fund another 10,000 ICE officers, and we're asking for that, so that we can eliminate MS-13 and root out the criminal cartels from our country. Now, we're getting them out anyway, but we'd like to get them out a lot faster. And when you see these towns, and when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand, like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Intentionally injuring a suspect is illegal for police to do. The Suffolk County Police Department issued a statement afterwards making clear that it, quote, will not tolerate roughing up of prisoners, unquote. Locally, San Diego Sheriff candidate Dave Myers issued a statement criticizing Sheriff Bill Gore for not speaking out on the issue, but he added, I'm not staying silent. Myers said, our police officers are strong civil servants and they deserve better leadership at the top. This harmful rhetoric puts our deputies in danger while serving their communities. Myers is a sergeant in the sheriff's department locally with 32 years of experience in law enforcement. Chuck Wexler, executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, told radio station WTOP, the last thing we need is a green light from the President of the United States for officers to use unnecessary force. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Authorities are asking for public help to find out who taped shut the muzzle of a dog later abandoned in Santee. The 3-month-old black terrier is now recovering at County Animal Services after it was dumped outside a Santee fast food restaurant last Wednesday, July 25th. A witness reported seeing an orange Dodge Charger stop, pause, then pull away. The puppy ran from the spot where the Dodge had been, then hid beneath another vehicle. The puppy had injuries from what appeared to have been rubber bands or some other material that had been wrapped around his snout. County Animal Services Director Dan D'Souza says, there's no question this puppy has been abused. The dog didn't have any identification, so he will go up for adoption once he's fully recovered. Based upon the seriousness of the dog's injuries, the department may start an animal abuse investigation. Anyone with information on the case can call the department at 619-498-2305. A suspect could face up to 3 years in prison, a fine of up to $20,000, or both. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Andrew Zelt. He is the first Republican challenger who has announced that he's running against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. He is a sergeant at the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, working at the Detentions Court Service Bureau. He's worked for the sheriff for the last 13 years since he was 21 years old. He was born and raised in El Cajon and currently resides in Rancho San Diego. He says he can no longer support Congressman Hunter, who is under criminal investigation for allegedly spending campaign finance funds on personal uses. Now, we should note that Congressman Hunter has denied any wrongdoing. However, he has taken out a loan to repay over $60,000 to his campaign, and he is under investigation by both the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI. Andrew Zelt says that he is running because the people of the 50th District deserve a better representative than what they currently have. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. Happy to be here.
Well, we're pleased that you've joined us today. Now, I'd like to start by asking, what are your top priorities if you're elected?
My number one top priority is the people of District 50. They need to have the right representative for them, something they currently do not have, something that I think that the rest of the field doesn't provide them. So my top priority is the people, hearing what the people's needs are. And that's going to vary from person to person.
Sure.
And that's okay. But my top priority is listening to the people, finding out what are some of the things that affect you, your day-to-day lives. And then expand on that to the nation and the country. What are some of your concerns about the way our nation is going? I want to hear that so that I can best represent you in Congress.
Other than the ethics concerns swirling around your opponent, are there any actual policy issues where your views are different than Congressman Hunter? And I should add, are there some areas where you agree with his views?
In all fairness, you're always going to have some things from different candidates that you might agree with here and there. I'm a traditional Republican. I believe in some of the same things that Mr. Hunter would say he believes in, such as strong border security, a balanced budget. Some of those things are going to be the same, but we're going to be miles apart when it comes to integrity, when it comes to honesty, and when it comes to being a leader, which is what you should be when you're representing your constituents in Congress. That's something I have not seen him do. He hasn't been on the forefront of very many issues, and that's something that I promise to the people of District 50 that I will be. I'll be on the forefront. You're going to see me out there fighting for things such as fires, getting the right fire equipment, making sure that, you know, the state's getting reimbursed for all of its firefighting efforts in the national forests, which is right here in our own very backyard. We have Cleveland National Forest.
Yeah, critical issue here in East County. And we're going to be talking about all of these issues in more in depth. But let's start with our military personnel and their families and our veterans. Representative Hunter is a veteran, of course. He served his country in Iraq and Afghanistan. We certainly honor and thank him for his service. He also serves on the House Armed Services Committee. Andrew, what do you believe our nation's priorities should be when it comes to our military personnel and our veterans? And I should add military families.
Yeah, that is a huge part of our country, and it always has been a huge part of our country. The military deserves our full support, and their families deserve our full support, because the men and women that serve in our military don't serve on their own. Their families serve with them. These are long stints that they have to spend out of the country. And so a lot of these parents act as single parents while their spouse is serving in the military across the seas. So we need to make sure that we're providing them with all the resources that we can to help them, to make sure that they're being provided for. Especially our veterans, you know, on healthcare, that they're getting the needs met. We cannot neglect these. They have done a great service for our country and for our people, and we need to make sure that we do a great service for them in return.
Okay. Andrew, what do you believe our nation's foreign policy priorities should be, and are there areas where your views differ from either Representative Hunter, or for that matter, the Trump administration or the prior administration under Obama?
National security is a big issue for me. It's extremely important. I had a larger issue with the way our nation was handling things under the previous 8 years under President Obama. I believe that a lot of the things he did kind of undermined America's strength. And I applaud President Trump for some of the actions that he's taken as far as Syria is concerned, with the missile strikes. I think that sent a clear message that we were no longer going to tolerate rogue regimes pushing and killing innocent people.
We did just have a story this week about the city of Raqqa that's been partially liberated from ISIS and the women out there burning their burqas in celebrations. I'd like to ask, though, the House and Senate just overwhelmingly approved sanctions against Russia for Russian actions in the Ukraine and efforts to interfere in the U.S. election. President Trump, however, has promised Vladimir Putin that the U.S. will stop arming Syrian rebels who are opposed to the Bashar Assad regime in Syria, and that's an action that Russia has long wanted to see done. Do you believe that the U.S. should be supporting Assad, or should they be backing the rebels who are seeking to oust Assad from power?
This is a complex issue, and I believe that Assad should go. I don't think that you can commit the atrocities that he has done and still truly remain the leader of a country that's going to be united. So I believe that Assad has to eventually go. That being said, peace might take a while, and there might have to be some different negotiations that take place to get to that point. So perhaps a starting point is disarming the rebels going against Assad, but if that can lead to other things, such as working out negotiations to an Assad exit, then I would say it is a good step in the right direction. If the final end game is to keep Assad in power, then I would say that's probably a step in the wrong direction. So right now, we don't have all the information, unfortunately, and we don't know exactly which road we're going down. But could this be a potential good first step into bringing peace to the region and maybe ushering in a new Syrian government? Possibly. We have to wait and see.
Okay. As a career law enforcement person, Andrew, are there areas in the criminal justice system where you believe more resources or priorities are needed at the federal level? And if so, where?
Without a doubt, mental illness is the number one priority for me that I think the federal government can truly help states, counties, with funding. When you look at mental illness, it's across the board. It's not just in our district or in our city or in our state. It's nationwide. So this is a federal issue. A lot of these individuals that have mental illness, they end up on our streets and they end up in our jail system. And that's really, truly not the place for them. They would be better served in mental health facilities, getting the care that they so desperately need.
Yeah, do you think it could actually be cost effective to put a little money up front into care for the health care for the mentally ill, as opposed to having to deal with them when they wind up in the criminal justice system, in the prisons, and on the streets?
Absolutely. I mean, when somebody goes to one of our jails, we, the taxpayers, have to pay money to support them. I would rather pay that same money to go to mental health facilities that are really going to help those individuals really get down and provide the true help that they need, and an in-depth help. Because these individuals, if prescribed the right medications and the right treatment plans, can be very productive members of our society.
You have said that you support a safe and secure border. Your opponent, Duncan Hunter, of course, has been pretty much the architect of the border wall, supports, I think, a wall along every inch of the border if he could have his way, as does President Trump. Do you believe that a wall is needed along the entire border, or do you think that security could be achieved in some places through technology and save some of that money for some of these other priorities you've talked about, like maybe mental health care?
Absolutely. A border wall sounds good. It sounds secure and safe. In reality, I'm not so sold. There might be other ways to make the border more secure than just a wall. Mm-hmm. To me, immigration is one issue, but drugs are another huge issue that we have at the border.
And then we've seen tunnels and catapults and all kinds of ways to get them over here, even with a wall.
Absolutely, Miriam. You're absolutely right. And that's where I'm kind of going with that is the tunnels. There's an estimated 180 tunnels any one time between California and Arizona.
Unbelievable.
And these go undetected a lot. And there's been some media coverage recently how the Border Patrol is sitting there and they're saying we don't really have all the technology we need to detect these tunnels.
Yeah,
and
they're flying them in too now on glider planes and drones, I've heard now.
Right.
Smugglers are very creative, unfortunately.
We need to be at the forefront of this. We need to see what the bad guys are doing, how they're doing it, so we can combat that. And drug tunnels are a huge business. They cost millions of dollars to build these tunnels.
Yeah.
These drug cartels are fine with putting up that money because it is a billion-dollar industry.
So maybe electronic sensors and surveillance might be a better way to go in certain areas, and maybe just allowing geography where there's very rugged terrain or rivers, you know, maybe we don't need it everywhere.
Correct. There's going to be some natural barriers that are there that we don't need a wall per se. And I think technology, having the right staffing along the border, all these things are what's truly going to promote border security for immigration and for the illegal narcotics pouring across our borders.
What are your views on immigration, and what are your thoughts about the current sort of mass deportation policies that we are seeing under the present administration in Washington?
Immigration is obviously on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. One of the big things that I have with immigration is that we are a nation of immigrants, and we welcome people from all sorts of nations and all sorts of faiths. It doesn't matter, and they add to the great American dream. That being said, we are also a nation of laws, and I want people to come over here legally and follow the rules of society. Now, I think there's a lot that we can do to help make it more affordable for individuals to become a U.S. citizen. I think that there's things that we can do maybe to speed up that process while maintaining security and background checks. But I'm all for people coming to this nation legally. Illegal immigration is a much more difficult topic to deal with, and we should look on a case-by-case basis and then decide what's the best route to do this. Now, do we condone thousands upon thousands that have broken the law? Maybe not so much. We'll have to take a look and see, can we speed up a process? Can we get the citizenship going for these individuals?
Yeah. Does it matter if they've been here for many, many years? Does it make a difference to you as a law enforcement person if maybe someone broke a law by coming here, perhaps seeking to protect their family or find a safe haven? Does it matter if they've lived here many years without committing any other crime versus those who perhaps have engaged in other illegal activities?
My viewpoint is the law is the law. If they broke the law by coming over here, that was probably not the best start for them for the American dream. They need to come legally. They need to be provided the resources, whether that be a quicker process. And those that want to flee here for persecution issues can come over as refugees. There are those ways that it can be done. A lot of immigration that we're talking about is, illegal immigration from Mexico. Mexico's government doesn't want to do anything for border security because it's a money industry for them as well.
What about the children who were brought here by parents who entered illegally, but the children themselves didn't commit a crime, and yet they're being deported, some of them who've been here their whole lives, so to speak? Now there is a bipartisan DREAM Act, Republican and Democratic co-authorship, that's just been introduced in Congress specifically to protect the people who were brought to the U.S. as babies or children. Would you support protecting those vulnerable young people?
I would. If we're going to be a nation that is compassionate and understanding, then I think you should support such a thing. If a child was brought over here at an early age, let's say it was from Mexico, because their parents wanted a better life. Now, yes, the parents maybe didn't do it legally, but that baby had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Maybe that individual, maybe they don't speak the language, they don't know the culture, and is it fair for our nation to deport them to a country that they really truly do not know? I would say probably not. And I think that's why you get bipartisan support for such bills.
Yeah, that's a compassionate view on that. Healthcare reform is arguably the defining issue of our time. As we're taping this week, the Senate has just voted to open debate on repealing and possibly replacing Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act as it's known, and yet they've been unable to come up with the votes needed to pass any of their Republican bills proposed. Andrew, what are your views on healthcare, and specifically, what would you need to see in a healthcare measure included for you to consider supporting it if this is not already resolved by the time you get back to Congress if you're elected?
Healthcare is another one of those really difficult topics because there's so many different angles you can approach this from. First and foremost, it has to be feasible. Whatever plan we have has to be feasible. If it's not, over time, it'll just collapse upon itself, much like what we're seeing with some of the Obamacare situation right now. People pulling out of the exchanges, things becoming less affordable. The system is slowly falling apart, so it needs help.
We should note, I mean, the Trump administration, they've said they're going to let it fail, but in some ways they're sort of actively encouraging that by, for example, yanking the funding to educate and inform people about the sign-up deadlines for Obamacare and some of the reimbursements that were promised to insurers for certain things.
Yeah, and to let something fail, if that's what the Trump administration is doing, because it seems like they're frustrated that a bill hasn't been passed, that we're not making progress. That's something that if it's failing now and it's on life support, so to speak, and it's going to be propped up for another 2 years to say, you know what, let it fail now so that we can make progress on it, then I don't know that's the worst thing if that's going to force people into action. And I think essentially that's probably what President Trump is trying to do, is force people into action. What we need to do for healthcare is A, make sure it's feasible. B, make sure that we do protect those individuals that have pre-existing conditions. I think these are things that can get bipartisan support. Nobody wants to see somebody left out that can't help that. That's not something that they can change. But it has to be affordable. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Everybody does pay something. So taxes go up. The money has to come from somewhere.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. When I talk to voters, what I hear most often is they're so frustrated because on the one hand, you have Democrats who say, you know, Obamacare, good. I don't want to hear about any problems with it. And we all know there are some things about it that were good. In my own family, we've seen some things where it helped and some things where there were issues. My daughter had a pituitary tumor at the base of the brain. She had very nearly decided not to have health care and save some money, and we talked her out of that, pointed out there were going to be some penalties kicking in. She might want to rethink that, and thank goodness she got it, and it saved her life. But on the other hand, it can be very expensive for some people in the middle. Sometimes the subsidies, it's great if you're low income, but if you're a little higher income, there are some gaps. There's some insurers that have pulled out and so forth. And on the other hand, we have the Republicans who say, let's just repeal Obamacare. But our plan, according to the Congressional Budget Office, depending which Republican plan you look at, is going to result in 20 to 30 million people losing health insurance completely. So on the one hand, I understand there's people who oppose mandates, don't want to be told they have to buy insurance. And on the other hand, how does anybody justify taking health insurance away from 20 or 30 million people? Congressman Hunter, in his town hall, said that he believes health care is not a right, should not be a right. Do you think it should be?
I would say that calling something a right can get people into a lot of kind of a muddy area. And being in the law enforcement community, a lot of times I've seen a lot of people claim, I have a right to this or I have a right to that.
And should it be affordable and accessible to every American in some fashion?
And I think that yes, I think a lot of people would agree that sure, it should be as a compassionate society, should we have something or be able to come up with something? Yes. But once again, it goes back to it has to be feasible, because if it isn't and the system collapses, well, then nobody has health care.
Right.
And so you have to make sure that you can afford it. And whether you call it a right or not, it is something that I think we should definitely do as a society. And there's a couple different options that might be available that we could experiment with, such as maybe a voucher system where individuals are given X amount, whatever is decided upon when you look at the numbers. And then what they can do with that is go and shop around for healthcare that works for their needs. And that creates open competition. So that's something that our country has thrived on.
All right. Well, we appreciate you sharing your views with us on that important issue. Another important issue is the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. His investigation has turned up what appears to be deepening evidence of ties between certain Trump campaign officials, family members, even some cabinet officials with Russians. And yet the president has fired the FBI director. He's threatened to fire the special prosecutor now, and potentially even his attorney general, because he recused himself from all matters related to the Russian investigation, which is required since he was involved in the Trump campaign, without assuming any guilt by any of the players, because of course you're innocent until proven guilty. Do you believe it is appropriate to assure at minimum that an independent investigation is conducted without interference from those who are under investigation?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way that our society should work in all matters. It doesn't matter what party you belong to. An independent investigation should have free will to look into things that they need to without being interfered by either side.
Okay. Thank you for that. As far as the concern about Russian interference in the U.S. elections, and certainly we do know now from the testimony of those who've spoken before the Senate Intelligence Committee that at the very least the Russians did attempt to penetrate voting systems in numerous states. I think it's 30-something states, among other things, trying to get into voter databases. You know, who knows if they got further than that. Are you concerned that the administration, you know, their voter integrity panel seems to be more concerned with whether illegal aliens were voting, which certainly if there's fraud, you know, that should be dealt with, but they've shown absolutely zero interest in how to prevent Russians or anybody else from hacking U.S. elections. What do we do? Should Congress be taking some action on that particular front?
That's an interesting one to me, because this goes back to what were the Democrats doing the last 8 years under President Obama?
Yeah.
Nobody said anything about these situations previous. As a matter of fact, the Democrats laughed at and criticized Mitt Romney on his campaign when he said that one of the greatest threats was Russia. Now, he said socioeconomic threat, and the Democrats laughed at him. Even President Obama made a comment about the Cold War was over years ago.
Yeah, well, in hindsight, maybe that was a mistake on their part, too.
Agreed. And I think what Mitt Romney observed was, I think what a lot of Republicans have seen as well, is that, no, the Russians are a difficult nation to deal with. They are still struggling with their own identity after the collapse of the Soviet Union. You have Putin, who has been able to manipulate and stay in power, and you continuously see that from the Russians.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people in the government know that the Russians really probably can't be trusted. That being said, we have to try to work with them on certain things.
Sure.
In global affairs. They are a big partner and player, so we have to do our best to get along in certain areas and work together. But all the while being very wary and cautious. And the Democrats said nothing about this under Obama's administration.
Yeah. Well, and I would agree that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans seem to be the least bit concerned about touchscreen voting machines. I should mention, this is something where I won a National Reporting Award a few years ago for exposing the dangers of certain touchscreen voting machines. I actually interviewed a whistleblower from inside the Diebold Election Company, came to me and told me he was rather ashamed afterwards about how they'd been involved in rigging elections in Georgia with these machines and how this was done. That story led to a shareholder lawsuit against Diebold and the CEO resigning within days, and that company eventually getting out of the election business. And our, at the time, Deborah Bolin, who was the Secretary of State in California, banning those machines in the state of California, other than for disabled, maybe blind voters. And yet those same machines are still in use in multiple states. It happens to be mostly red states. But if there's no way to trace a hack and a change of votes, which happened undetected in Georgia, shouldn't those voting machines just be outlawed wherever they are? Shouldn't we have to have at the very least a paper trail where you could go back and audit if there was a question about the integrity of election, whether it's Russians or anybody else, just routine, you know, hacking by political parties or something, shouldn't there be a way to audit and find out for sure if an election was honest?
No, I absolutely agree. Technology is a great thing, and it allows us to do many things, and it allows us to do things in a timely and quick manner. Mm-hmm. But there are some things that we might want to take a serious look at to say, maybe the old way we did it is a good way.
Paper.
And you're absolutely right. Paper is not foolproof. Could things still be tampered with? Yes, but it would be much more difficult and not just at the will of a hacker hacking into the system and changing votes. So there are definitely things that I think can be done and probably should be done to make sure that we do secure the integrity of our election process.
Well, yeah, I mean, when it's paper, to the degree that there's tampering, it's much more limited to maybe a particular precinct. Somebody throws out a box of ballots or something.
Agreed.
But you can't go in and massively change votes for an entire county or an entire state.
Absolutely. And that's why it's probably a much better system than going to some of the electronic voting that we have.
Yeah,
now,
I agree.
I also find, to go back to your question about the Trump campaign being more, or Trump administration, I should say, being more concerned about illegal immigration voting and things of that nature, you know, I can find for you a lot more dead people that voted and a lot more illegal immigrants than voted than Russians, most likely. So I don't think that they're that off base with saying we have another issue. Whether you want to get into voter ID, but I can go, and if I know my friend, Bob Johnson, isn't going to vote, and I can show up and say, I'm Bob Johnson, and go ahead and vote. And we know that there's voter fraud that happens in states along those lines. So that's something that is concerning. We should always be concerned about the integrity, not just from outside sources like the Russians tampering.
From all forms, whatever they are.
We should do our best to secure it.
Okay. Andrew, where do you stand on Second Amendment rights versus the concerns of those favoring gun control? Your stance is basically on gun issues and public safety.
I am a firm believer in the Second Amendment. I believe that everybody has the right to defend themselves, to defend their home and their family. And, you know, a lot of the things that you see with gun control, it has to be common sense.
Like background checks for the mentally ill or something.
Correct. We need to do what we can as far as mental illness, individuals that have criminal records, to make sure that they don't get firearms. That being said, there's also things that we enact that sometimes it's a feel good, but doesn't always truly have the effect that we would like it to have. If you're going to create a gun safe zone at a school, that sounds very good. But in reality, that's just a sign. And what we need to understand is that sign isn't going to stop anyone. A civilian that is able to carry, say, a concealed weapon that has a permit is a much safer individual. You know, whether they are picking up their kid or their grandchild from the school, they shouldn't feel I have to leave my concealed weapon, which I have a permit for, at home because I'm going to a quote unquote gun safe zone. That doesn't make the school more safe. It makes the school less safe. And those individuals, those citizens that have, say, a concealed carry permit, they pass their tests. They are a citizen that has no criminal record.
So they've been vetted already.
They've been vetted. That is a far safer individual than a lot of the other people out there. The criminals are always going to get the weapons. No matter what kind of gun control laws you put into place, the bad guys will always find a way to get the weapons. You take Mexico, for example. The firearms are illegal. And yet, crime is rampant, and the cartels are the ones with the firearms.
Speaking of public safety, I think in East County, the public safety issue probably that's first and foremost on everybody's mind is wildfires. It's really the great leveler we saw during the 2007 wildfires. 500,000 people evacuated. It was the largest evacuation at the time in world history for any natural disaster. And yet, right now, as you've alluded to, we're seeing the U.S. Forest Service cutting money for firefighting. They're not reimbursing CAL FIRE for fighting fires on forest lands, and CAL FIRE is actually saying they may just stop fighting fires in places like Cleveland National Forest. And the latest thing is the Forest Service is banning a large capacity air tanker from being used to fight wildland fires, or saying they're going to send it out with only a small fraction of the amount of fire retardant that it's capable of holding, all to pinch a few pennies. And of course, Diane Jacob is still trying to get them to get certain air tankers to take off from the Ramona Air Base. They said their planes can't land or take off there. The Cal Fire guys went out and put a video out showing themselves landing and taking off the same plane. Mm-hmm. But yet the Forest Service just doesn't seem to listen on these things. Would you be a vocal fighter if you get back there to change some of that?
Absolutely. I applaud Diane Jacob and the work that she's done to draw attention to this. Cleveland National Forest is right here in our district. It is butts right up against people's backyards. And if the state was to say, hey, we're not going to have Cal Fire go out and fight these fires because we just don't get reimbursed from the federal government anymore and we can't afford to do that, those fires are just going to spread and they're going to go into people's backyards and homes, and we're going to have an even bigger humanitarian crisis on our hands. That's risking people's lives. That's risking their homes and their families. And that is completely unacceptable to me. You bet I would be on the forefront of this and doing everything that I could to ensure that the feds are paying their fair share, what they should be paying, to help reimburse the state so that we can get these fires taken care of and dealt with. And I support any measure that's going to bring us more firefighting equipment that can put out these fires before they come, these behemoths that destroy millions and millions of dollars of property and people's lives.
Good. I'm sure that's one issue probably everybody listening out there would agree on. It's interesting because when I talk to firefighting chiefs, I haven't heard any climate change deniers among their ranks. Every one of them will tell you these fires are getting bigger, they're getting worse, and they really think that climate change is at least one factor in that. It's just hotter, it's drier, the fire seasons are getting longer and longer and longer. And yet, you know, we have an administration that basically has said they don't believe climate change is real or that man's actions can affect it. Do you think that's short-sighted, perhaps?
If you're going to state that what we do as humans and what we put into the air doesn't have any effect, I would say, yeah, that's short-sighted. And I think, of course, it does have an effect. We definitely need to focus on renewable energy, clean energy. Those are some of the big things that we do need to focus on.
Like solar.
Things of that nature. And with each of those, as you've pointed out, I know in the past, is they come with gives and takes and certain environmental problems with certain things such as the large windmills.
Well, that's true. They certainly bring their own environmental and community problems with the noise and the infrastructure. A lot of it is about placement. It might be fine somewhere offshore. It's not so fine if it's putting 500-foot tall turbines next to a town. And yet, alternative energy can be a very positive thing. Solar, and it can also create jobs. We're seeing a clean, green economy in San Diego based around that. So it's a matter, again, I think, of balance. And
I agree. I think it's a balance issue. And what I want to ensure is that we do our best to come up with renewable energy and clean energy technologies. But I also sit there and say we should not be squashing businesses and economic growth because we handcuff ourselves with policies that are too extreme. One of the big issues that I know a lot of people have talked about is the Trump administration pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement.
Right.
And then one of the things that gets lost a lot of times is what they said right after that. They want to renegotiate the deal, essentially. They want what's best for Americans. When you look at that climate deal in its entirety, and everybody touts that everybody in the world, except for a couple countries, was part of this agreement. Well, if you're a poor country, it sounds like a pretty good plan to have the big rich country come in and pay for all of your resources to be renewed and clean energy and things of this nature. That sounds like a pretty good deal for them. For the American taxpayer that has to foot the bill, not only for our own nation to meet certain standards, but for a lot of other countries to meet the standards and we're paying their bills, yeah, that's maybe not the best deal for the American people. Not to say that we don't want the best for our environment, not to say that we're going to really do our best to lower emissions, which we should. We are stewards of the environment.
So you don't want us to go back to the era of, say, coal-fired plants every place?
No, I think we can. I have nothing against that right now for an energy source that we might need. However, we should always be looking at new technologies mm-hmm. and a new way to do things.
So the cleanest energy source that's cost effective, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of that, President Trump has been calling for allowing oil drilling off California's coast, which actually has been banned for a lot of years. I think the memory of the two Santa Barbara oil spills is very fresh in many Californians' minds. What are your views on offshore drilling? And I'd also like to ask, what do you believe should be done with the nuclear waste at San Onofre?
Okay, on the first issue of offshore drilling, I believe that there's still a large portion of our economy that can benefit from that. Now, it has to be done with environmental protections in place. Once again, we have to be good stewards and make sure that we have every safeguard to make sure that there are not spills, that there is not damage to the environment. That's being a good steward. But do I have a problem with offshore drilling? No, I do not. If it's going to help, once again, lower the prices of something that everybody needs, our products, our gas, if we lower the price of all these products, that's more money in people's pockets, that's more money for their families, and I think overall that benefits the economy. As long as it's done in an environmentally safe manner, I think that that's something we can explore. As far as the waste at San Onofre, we have to find, once again, a responsible and reasonable storage for that nuclear waste. It's there. We have to get rid of it in a safe manner.
So you don't think just keeping it on the beach in these shallow storage bins that are only guaranteed to last for 20 years is a good idea?
No, I don't think that's a good idea. I think it needs to go to a secure facility where it can be stored for the foreseeable future in a safe manner.
Okay. You've said that religious freedom is important to you. Andrew, can you elaborate on what your definition of religious freedom is? What does that mean to you?
What religious freedom means to me is that no matter what your background, your religious belief, you're protected from persecution. And that's what's so great about this country, is we can have different beliefs. We can have a church next to a synagogue, next to a mosque, and we can get along. And we can respect that the other people have a different belief than our own. And that's fine. That's what makes America great and a safe place. You don't get that in a lot of other places in the world. You go to the Middle East, you're not going to find a church next to a synagogue, next to a mosque.
No, they'll be bombing them and persecuting you.
They will. I believe in religious protections, and I believe that we have to be very cautious not to infringe upon people's beliefs just because maybe, say, another group is uncomfortable with those beliefs and doesn't like it or doesn't share those same beliefs. We have to be very cautious not to persecute the other group. They have a right to believe what they'd like. However, we have to be very cautious as well. Things like Sharia law. Okay, so things like that don't have any place in our nation or in our judicial
right.
system.
Right. I mean, that basically would violate other people's constitutional rights. We certainly have rights
Correct.
And freedoms that would infringe upon. You have indicated that you are pro-life. Congressman Hunter, when he first was elected, co-authored a bill that would have declared life begins at conception, and it would have had no exceptions allowing abortion, even for rape, incest, or a mother's life in danger. Do you share that view, Andrew, or do you believe there's some need for balance between protecting unborn children versus protecting the life and health of women or teens who may be victims of rape or have conditions that could put their lives at risk if they give birth?
I believe that every life is important, even the unborn life. I believe that certain situations and circumstances can be very difficult for people.
Yeah.
And if you have cases such as rape, incest, or mother's life in danger, I think that there probably should be some exceptions for those individuals in those situations. They did not put themselves in that situation. It was forced upon them. I do believe that a life does begin at conception, and those lives deserve our protection as well as anybody else. It doesn't make a lot of sense for me to say, okay, now that this baby has been born, it has every right and freedom as anybody else, but, 6 months ago, it didn't have any. I believe that we need to be protective. Now, what I also believe, I definitely think there's a need for balance in some of these cases. If a mother's life is in danger, in cases of rape or incest, yes, I think because this choice was forced upon them, they didn't make it freely, then there should be exceptions in certain situations and circumstances.
So you think the life of the mother matters. Also, the life of a baby or unborn baby is important, but we have to weigh that also against the life and the health of the mother?
We do. In those situations, we definitely have to really take a look at it and see the situation medically. You know, is the mother's life in danger? I think we have to really look at that. My big stance, too, is I don't like the concept of abortions. I don't believe in that. That's not my religious belief. But I think that we can do a lot to combat the amount of abortions by education and offering up alternatives to an abortion. If you're a young, struggling mother and you feel that this is your only way out of a difficult situation, I want you to have resources that say, you know what, there's another way. If you can't care for the baby, maybe you could give it up to adoption to a family that would really love to have the child.
You know, this goes to the healthcare situation again, too, because it's interesting. I read a while back that the number one reason why women give who go into an abortion clinic asking for an abortion is that they don't believe they can afford to either care for the baby or give birth to the baby. And it can be $30,000 or $40,000 if your health insurance doesn't cover it, just to pay for the delivery cost. Maybe, you know, do you think if we made sure that everybody had a policy that would cover at least the basic cost of giving birth to a baby, that maybe we'd see more who'd be willing to do the right thing and give it up for adoption as opposed to getting that abortion because of economic constraints?
Yeah, that's something that we can definitely work into a healthcare bill, like the pre-existing conditions, where I think we can tweak and manage to make it right. Is something in this particular circumstance where, okay, maybe if you have a mother that, okay, those bills are paid for so that she can have the baby and doesn't feel like she's going to get saddled with $40,000 in debt for the delivery. So that, so that that doesn't factor into her decision making and kind of sway her one way or the other. And those are things that we can look at in a healthcare bill and go through and determine what's best for the people for those kind of coverages.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. You have criticized Congressman Hunter for engaging in stunts on rather trivial matters, such as vaping on the Senate floor to protest a bill that would ban electronic cigarettes on airplanes, for example. While he's failed to enact what you or what many people would consider really meaningful legislation to help people in his district, usually his bills seem to deal with, you know, naming post offices or battleships or something. But it begs the question, Andrew, if you were elected, what bills or actions would you take to directly benefit the people in the 50th Congressional District?
That's one of the things that I want to bring to this district is some fresh ideas, some stuff that we have been lacking for a long time from Congressman Hunter especially. Because, yes, he's naming post office boxes instead of sitting there and fighting to make sure that we're getting the funds to fight the fires.
Yeah.
He should be more worried about his constituents than himself. And he's not on the forefront. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be on the forefront of these issues that affect our district. And when you look at it, some of the things that I would like to do, some of the fresh ideas would be, what affects everybody? Water, right?
Ah, yes.
Water is a huge one, not just for the district, but for a large part of California, especially Southern California.
So what would your water priorities or ideas be?
So some of my original concepts here for what we would kind of attack when we get in there into Congress is securing more federal funds for water solutions in the state of California. The state of California produces a vast majority of this nation's agriculture.
True.
A huge amount of its fruits and vegetables and products, farming, dairy, it produces a large number for the country. So,
yeah, a lot of those fields were fallowed during the 6 years of drought.
Absolutely. And so when California feels the pinch, when our district feels the pinch, the nation will feel the pinch of that drought. And one thing that we know is that we're going to have droughts in Southern California and in California in general. We're going to have them. We had a good winter this last year, but so unfortunately, the kind of winters that we had last year don't happen all the time. So we know that we're always going to have drought problems. And yet, some of our water issues are not taken care of. So what I want to push at the federal level is more funding federally that will work with state in securing other water solutions for California, whether that be potentially desalinization plants. Mm-hmm. Those are extremely expensive, and that's one of the drawbacks that people always mention. Well, let's spread out the cost and make it more affordable.
More water storage.
Storage, especially underground water storage, is a large one, because then it doesn't evaporate. And then we don't lose all that water. We can retain that. So underground water storage is another one that we really need to look at. So securing federal funds to help the state, and that's going to help provide safety for the nation agriculturally. You know, when we're hit with these droughts, because all the food products go up, there's shortages.
Yeah, water really is a security issue. Let's talk about jobs for a minute and the local economy. We have a thriving economy largely in the county, but out in East County, there are certainly some pockets of very, very high unemployment as well as very high poverty. For example, in the city of El Cajon and in some of the rural communities out there. Do you have ideas for bringing some better paying jobs and industries perhaps out here to East County? We seem to have a lot of high tech and biotech and clean tech jobs, but they seem to all be going to the city of San Diego and Poway. Why can't we have that in, I don't know, Spring Valley or Lakeside or El Cajon or Alpine?
No, I think we can. I think we can have those type of jobs here. We have to provide the right incentives to get these companies to want to come out to our community, to our district, and set up shop here and provide jobs for the people of this district out in this area. That's something that we have to take a look at and figure out what's the best way to go about that. There's a whole wide variety of different types of jobs and industries that you could take a look at. When you look at San Diego in general, where is there to grow? You talk about, say, the construction industry and things of that nature. Well, we're pretty much landlocked to the west. There's nowhere to go to the north or south.
Right.
East County, which is District 50.
Where the land is more
affordable. Where there is more affordable land, which, once again, if we can bring businesses in to, hey, we got land out here. We can build a warehouse out here. We can employ people in these neighborhoods in this district that live out here to create an affordable product. Those are some big things that we can do. We got to take a look at the different industries that we want out in our communities, first and foremost.
Right.
And to give people jobs here.
Okay. Senator John McCain, in an impassioned speech on the Senate floor this week after he returned from brain cancer surgery, has called for less partisanship and a return to senators who actually are willing to work across the aisle when needed, putting country first over party on important issues such as health care, for example, and many others. Do you agree with that value and that statement of Senator McCain's?
First and foremost, I wish Senator McCain the best. I hope that he's able to fight this and recover well from it. And I absolutely agree with him. And I think that most people would agree with him. We need civility in politics.
Yes.
We need to be able to sit down and talk about the issues and figure out what is best, not for party, not for the Democrats or the Republicans, but what is best for all Americans. I think that's the right thing to do. And I think that's something that we can get to, but there's always going to be some people on the fringes, and they're going to be a little loud. But I think a majority of the Americans would agree with that and do want civility to return.
They're tired of the name-calling and the insults. They want people who will look for actual, real solutions, I think. I hear that over and over from voters.
And absolutely. My thing, Miriam, is that I'm not about just words. And that's things like Duncan Hunter has. He had a lot of words. I'm about actions. We need to do and take action on some of these things that are affecting our communities. Name-calling doesn't do anything.
No. Okay. I have asked all of the Democrats that I've interviewed so far in this race. There's at least six of them running. I think we've had five of them on the show so far. And I'll ask you as well, Andrew, what makes you believe that you are strong enough to win this election against a field of all those Democrats, Congressman Hunter, if he stays in the race, anybody else the Republicans may put in, and if you do win, to be tough enough to stand up against all the special interests and all that money in Washington, D.C., and put the needs of constituents first?
With 13 years in the Sheriff's Department, I've dealt with a lot of bad people. I've dealt with some pretty interesting individuals, and I'm not going to shy away from a fight.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to sit here and fight for the people of this district. I'm not going to let a bunch of outside money come in, a lot that the Democrats are raising, maybe not from a super PAC, But if you go and look, it's all outside money coming in. I'm not going to let them come in here and do what they say they want to do, is flip the district.
Well, in fairness, we're seeing a lot of Republicans take a lot of special interest money, including Congressman Hunter through the years has taken huge amounts from certain industries. That vaping bill you talked about, we looked it up and he took a whole lot of money from the tobacco industry.
That happens, and that's a sad part of what happens in politics, but I'm not going to pull any punches. I'm going to fight for the people of this district. And you know where I'm going to stand on the issues, and you know that I'm going to go out there and fight hard for what you believe in and what matters most to you and your family and your beliefs. And you know I'm going to do it with honesty. I'm going to do it with integrity. And I'm not going to let you down. I've been born and raised in this community. It is a community that I love. It is a community that I've sworn to protect. And I will continue to do that. And so, yeah, some of the outside sources of money that are funneled in, it's sad to see, but you know what? I believe that the voters are smarter than that, and that they're going to vote with their heart, not with where somebody's pocketbook lies. So somebody can raise $1 million. That's good for them. But you know what? What are you going to do for the people of this district? And that's what I truly care about.
That is the most important question, I think, in this race and in almost any race across America. Andrew, if you are elected, will you commit to hold town halls regularly in your district, not telephone town halls, but actual in-person town halls in neutral venues that are accessible to all constituents, regardless of their parties or their viewpoints?
It's sad that you even have to ask the question, isn't it? Absolutely, I will. That's what our job is. And that's what I've said from the beginning, is I want to hear from the people of the district. What are your concerns? I don't care if you're a Democrat. I don't care if you're a Republican. I don't care if you're an independent. I want to hear what are some of the problems that you see, that you face, and how can we fix those? So absolutely, I would commit to that, holding town halls, having it open. I want to hear from people. That's our job as a representative of the people of this district.
Where can people get more information about you and your campaign?
They can go on to zeltforcongress.com. ZeltForCongress.com.
Okay, very good. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we've been speaking with Andrew Zelt, who is the first Republican who has announced that he is running against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District, joining a growing race that already has six Democrats in the pack as well. Andrew, I'm going to let you have the final word today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about yourself or your candidacy in the 50th Congressional District?
I'd like all the listeners out there to know that I'm here to fight for you. I'm here to fight for what you believe in. I'm here to stop outside sources coming in and changing the way that our communities do business. I know what we believe in because I'm one of them. I've been raised out in this community my entire life. It's where I'm raising my son and my family. And I will fight hard for you every single day. And I will do it with honesty, and I will do it with integrity. And you know that your representative will represent your best interests, and they will do it with a strong and moral backbone.
Listeners, if you tuned in the middle of this and you want to hear the complete interview, we will have this posted soon on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Just click the radio button, where you can also listen to interviews from everybody running. We're inviting all candidates in the race. Andrew, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam. I appreciate you having me on.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.